on ABC Radio.
This is The Big Fish
with Scott Levi.
Ahoy there. Welcome back to The Fish. Jump on board. Plenty to talk about. Things have been pretty dire after the massive algal bloom that killed huge numbers of marine creatures in South Australia. A real environmental tragedy. South Australia want the nation to know that the fishing's actually bouncing back. And there are still plenty of options, including giant brim, fantastic King George whiting, and some freshwater options that were previously off limits for anglers, for beautiful yellowbelly, or callop as they call them, and giant cod. They invited Steve and Joe Starling down to check it out. And that's our first cast this morning on The Big Fish. We take you to South Australia. It's The Big Fish, and Joe Starling, like the hobbits, has been on an adventure.
I have, Scott.
with the wonderful Steve Starling, her partner, with your South Australian sojourn. And I believe you were down there for a purpose, to tell people, hey, recreational angling is still alive and well despite the algal bloom.
That's right, that's right. And it was actually the Wreckfish South Australia initiative. So they invited us, along with a number of other Australian national sort of fishing personalities, to attend forums and in cahoots, I suppose, or in collaboration with an initiative they're running. I think it's called Let's Fish South Australia. It's similar to, I guess, the concept of the $1 million fish in the territory, where they've tagged a whole heap of fish and got them insured so that the South Australians can register and go and fish the reservoirs that South Australian water has opened up to fishing recently. And they're just stocked with, you know, Murray cod and yellowbelly, and there's silver perch. I should call it the yellowbelly callop, because that's what they call them over there. And all sorts of wonderful fish species that I guess we find harder to catch over here, whereas in those dams, they're really feisty and ready for a crack, possibly because they haven't been open for as long as some of ours over here, so the fish haven't seen as many lures. But
yeah, some of the impoundments you had a look at too. There was one that seemed to be in the Red Desert, which was quite extraordinary. And there'd been a flood, and the fish, yes, some of the fish had been washed downstream, and they were probably going to eventually die anyway. So even though you did release them to fight another day, but that was an incredible scene. It was like a Fisher cast. Big, big yellowbelly too, or callop, as they call them over there. They're weird, aren't they, those South Australians? I can say that because I know your heritage.
Yeah, I'm qualified.
You were born and bred, weren't you? Born in South Australia?
Born and bred. I have a Kangaroo Island and Riverland lineage. So I think I'm about as South Australian as you can get, except that I'm not.
Even you would, they're lovely, but they're different, aren't they? They're quite a different mob.
They are. My family, I go and visit them and leave thinking I have evolved so not above, but just divergent, you know, the rest of Australia. You can come from South Australia and go and live elsewhere, and you quickly assimilate into the rest of Australia. But South Australians are a unique breed, and I love them dearly, but it really is quite a cultural shift to go over to South Australia. It's a good, fun journey.
Yeah, and one thing we do have in common are certain fish species like the yellowbelly, or the callop, as they call them, because they've been tracked to do 3,000 Ks when the floods are on, yeah, and move. And these ones came down over this desert dam wall into these big pools down below that were shrinking in the heat. And you and Steve were just hitting these beautiful big fish one after the other. That was pretty exciting. I mean, talk about a hot bite.
It was. And even the small ones, and they were feisty as. We got Murray cod in there as well. And they would come from virtually under your feet. There was one pool in particular that was still quite deep, and so you could you could track your lure along, and once you got to know the particular pool well after the various casts that you'd have, you'd know, right, now I just pause or I let it sink for a little bit or what have you, and you knew that you were going to pull a strike. There must have just been a massive school of carp, yellow belly, sitting there, and then the cod would come out of the edges. And anyone who goes and watches that will see the extreme cliff that just comes up. It's like something out of a Kakadu waterhole. You know, there's this massive big escarpment above you. And, on that side there, Steve was pulling hits one after the other. Of course, being the main star of his YouTube channel, I sort of always try to give all the best spots to him so that, you know, he's framed in the gorgeous landscape. But I will claim I caught the biggest cod out of there.
Yeah, the yellow belly were beautiful. Beautiful looking fish. It's a bit sad, really. Hopefully South Australian Fisheries will go down and net them out maybe and put them back in the impoundment. But I'm sure there are plenty more of them up above the wall where they'd been stocked. And you also had this incredible... I was speaking with Joe Starling, who's just back from South Australia, where they're trying to reassure people that there are still fish to be caught, because all we've seen for months and months and months is gloom and doom on the telly of the massive algal bloom and fish kills. There's more to it than just that section of coast that's been devastated. And you were in the Coorong, and yes, you were catching juvenile mulloway one after the other after the other after the other. And they were tiny little ones up to about 30, 40 centimetres and smaller. Steve said it was one of the smallest mulloways he's ever caught. That's a very good sign, isn't it?
I would think so. And I'm not up to date with where the cohorts come from, whether or not our fishery of mulloway over here can be populated, you know, or fed by that as well. I'm not sure how far they travel. I don't know if you ask.
No, I'll ask. I know a few experts, so we might be able to find out. Yeah. We've had a few experts on the program over the years who have researched mulloway. Of course, they're quite a topic of discussion in New South Wales.
Absolutely.
with overfishing and making sure that we're doing it sustainably. But I believe those big beaches near the Coorong have always been hot spots for catching large mulloway, but these were tiny ones. I guess you've got to have little ones to grow into big ones, but that's a very good sign. And they probably do migrate around the coast. I mean, they do school up, don't they, and swim in vast schools, and they probably move up to Queensland and back down to Victoria and to South Australia. I mean, there are no boundaries for them, are there? But who knows? Who knows if they're a localised population or not? I don't know if
that's
the research has been done.
They would have to have a look at the genetics. But in any case, we do know that mulloway require good freshwater flows, even though they're an estuarine and saltwater fish. They require the good freshwater flows to trigger their spawning activity. So I guess the Coorong, given that in recent years there's been lots of water coming out of the Murray, so I do think that that's a really, really good sign. That, I mean, I think Steve caught a baby mulloway that was sort of 15 centimetres or something long. And there's just so immaculate and gorgeous and really extreme. At that time, when I say extreme, it's like the contrast has been turned up on their Photoshop settings, you know, and all the little dots are immaculate and really standing out there.
That's right. Well, our
is really glowing.
Our South Coast regular on the Big Fish, Beardy, got one the other day off the beach, 145 centimetres. So that gives you an idea of how big the small ones can grow, and 15 is just such a tiny one. But lots of them would suggest very good spawning and very good recruitment. So it's certainly not all gloom and doom in South Australia for the future. We're speaking with Joe Starling, and Joe and Steve, the dynamic duo of fishing, have been down in South Australia checking it out, and there's a big push with Wreckfish down there to get people back. I know you've caught them, but they are the one fish on my bucket list. I think I've caught just about everything that I've wanted to catch, apart from, you know, some exotic species overseas. But in Australia, I fished in Western Australia, fished in Tasmania, fished in Northern Territory, Queensland. You know, the one fish I haven't caught is the King George Whiting, and South Australia is really renowned for them. Did you have a crack at those on this trip or no?
No, we didn't. And it was because we were there to focus on mainly the freshwater, and we had the kayaks. So we were a little bit limited on coastal stuff with regards to what the wind was doing. We also, where we were based around the when Steve and I fish for King George, the thing that we love to do, or maybe I shouldn't speak for him, I love to do is go out first with my squid jig, catch my squid, which I will use for then the bait for my King George Whiting and eat the rest because
yeah,
I do love calamari.
That's brilliant. So they're quite different, aren't they, in that respect to yellowfin whiting? Because yellowfin whiting where I am and the very wary ones on the sand flats, you know, just north of Sydney, they wouldn't look at a bit of squid, even if it was totally fresh. They'll take, you know, the live nippers, the live worms, maybe a live prawn, you know, the ones that I fish for, the smaller ones will take bits of bait of anything really, but the big wary ones that are sight fishing on the shallow clear flats, they're after squirt worms particularly, and I know you've used those on the south coast as well, but the King George are a little bit more aggressive, I guess, in taking different things.
But they're also far more aggressive and strong, I mean size, but in their fight and what they'll do, I mean, they scream line, you know. So very, very different the places that you put it. Like, you're just not going to catch them unless you're popping your bait into a sandy patch within the weed beds, you know. They're not going to find it. They're going to sit in around the edges and they'll go out and find it in the sand patches between coral or weed beds or whatever the structure is. So it's all about placement. It's all about they're also very, very good at stealing your bait. So it's also about having contact with your bait at all times without moving. It's quite strategic. But, yeah, it's super-duper fun. Like, you've got to do it. And it's not just South Australia. So getting back to why we didn't, the calamari is relevant because my first question was, have you seen any squid? And the squid is something that has not come back yet from the algal bloom.
Right.
So
right.
I made the assumption that if the squid weren't going to be inshore or available, then neither would the King George Whiting. But of course, King George Whiting don't just eat squid bait. And so I did come across a fella who was cleaning a haul of about 10 King George Whiting all around the sort of 40 centimetre range. He said he had to work really hard for them, but it showed that they're coming back.
Where was he at, Joe? It's South Australia, so we can give away the secret spot.
Yeah, no, he was fishing off Brighton Beach.
Oh, that's right in town, isn't it?
Right in Adelaide. So,
that's
pretty cool. But for you, I would say do yourself a favour, Scott, and get yourself down to Tassie, because the northwestern corner of Tassie up at Montague, those areas, is just alive with King George Whiting that makes the South Australian ones look small.
Don't tell everyone. I've got to go down to Tassie. My daughter's expecting later in the year. So tell me off air about it?
You know my trick. Take your squid jigs.
it's the big fish. Yes, actually, a friend of mine, Ross, at Easter, you know, I was showing him all the fish I caught for the family. We were showing off, as you do with your mates, on you know, sending messages, and he sent me back his haul. He had two huge black brim, a heap of big squid, some lovely cockles. I don't know where he got those from. I'll have to ask him. And a whole heap of King George Whiting, some big silver trevally. So that was the fruits of their labour fishing in Tasmania. It's the big fish with Joe Starling, just back from South Australia. They're also a bit more oceanic, aren't they, the King George Whiting? You know, you can catch them and they'll move out to sea, whereas you don't really see, you'll never see a yellowfin whiting on the inshore reefs, you know, snapper fishing off the New South Wales coast. I've never heard of it, but the biggest King George we ever had on the Big Fish, and this was confirmed, was a fisherman from Wollongong who caught a 60, so just up the coast from where you live, caught a 63-centimetre King George whiting off Balambi Point out at sea, using a bit of squid too.
Yeah.
And that thing was just looked like a baseball bat.
Absolutely, more like a bonefish, right? So the that brings to mind the question about where are the fish in Tassie coming from, which is home base, you know, where is the parent population, because the Tassie ones are really big. They're like in that sort of game. And if we're getting those off Balambi Point and everywhere, and then in South Australia, they, you know, you tend to get to the 50-odd centimetre is a good fish and up and around. So it's all that triangle, but it would make you think that, because I know that in Port Phillip Bay and all of those areas in Victoria, they know they've got a nursery there. So it would just be really interesting to know where does it all, how does that whole population work, and, you know, are we going to see more and more of it over here in New South Wales? Because there was King George whiting, I can't remember where it was caught, but it was caught somewhere further up around the coast recently that was a real surprise too.
Yeah, it's fascinating. And, you know, we're getting back to talking about those South Australian mulloway, and if they're connected to our mulloway, maybe someone out there listening would know. Drop us a line at The Big Fish. You say that the King George whiting are big across Bass Strait. It's interesting because the kingfish are little. Well, the minimum size is just 45 centimetres. Of course, our minimum size is 65 centimetres, and there's a 5 per day bag limit, 10 in possession. And many in Tassie reckon that might be a bit small. They might need to take a leaf out of our book. Of course, our rules are because the scientists believe that over 65, you know, it gives them a chance to breed. The you know, if you're taking all those 65 centimetre fish and below, they're not getting to breeding age.
Mm. And I'm trying to rack my brain. It's been a few years now since I've been on the Rec Fish Advisory Council, but I'm pretty sure that even at 65, there's no guarantee at that point in time that the kingies have had the opportunity to breed. They're just starting to nudge into their sexual maturity. When I was on the advisory council, would have liked to have seen that a little bit higher. But I think that's why they were talking about or have introduced an upper limit as well, so that we've got a slot size, just to make sure that any that do get into that larger size have the opportunity to compensate for any that we take too early. So, it's really, really, really important for every species, I believe, that we understand where the sexual maturity size on average is for the particular species, and not just the species, and that's blanket, because that changes depending on where you are as well. Just the environmental impacts changes when the fish, different species, what size they're sexually mature at. And I think that a good sustainably minded, responsible recreational fisher would sort of say, all right, I want to know that, and I want to have my own limit to make sure that every fish they take has had a chance to breed at least once.
Yeah, that's a very good idea. We're speaking to Joe Starling on The Big Fish, just back from South Australia. And the other thing they have down there in abundance, and you caught some beauties, are the big black brim, different to our yellow fin brim. They live longer and get bigger, and they can be quite wily, and they get very dark. Although our yellowfin brim can get very dark in the tannin stained water as well. But phenomenal black brim fishing in South Australia, you know, around Port Pirie and everywhere, really. You caught some stonkers as well too, didn't you?
I did, yeah. And so did Steve. And they were back down in the Coorong as well. So hanging around with the mulloway were these stonking black brim. And the trick was just, flicking plastics up onto the coral beds. It's very, very shallow there in the Coorong. So we're finding anywhere that had a drop off and casting up onto the coral beds and dropping it down the face. And basically the All the fish, I imagine, were sitting, or certainly the brim, sitting up in amongst these, what they call coral. I think Steve was telling me it was sort of worm casings that, you know, had created and sort of calcified, and they called that a coral. And the fish are sort of sitting in amongst all of that, and then there's big drop-offs and they follow you out. And as soon as you look like you're going to escape, they just hit like a freight train. They were really exciting to catch.
Were you using soft plastics there or hard bodies? What were you?
They were soft plastics that I caught the brim on. Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah, they're a sucker for a grub tail, aren't they? They love the action of one of those sort of, I don't know, 1/16 jig head and a grub tail with a little bit of secret sauce on it, as Bushy and Starlo would say.
Yeah, that's right.
It's great that the doors are open for anglers to go to South Australia, because they really realised, didn't they, how important recreational fishing was after the fish kill and the bad publicity that meant a huge hit to the tourism bottom line all of a sudden.
Well, it does, but even beyond the dollars, we've got to think about the mental health of the fishers too. I mean, South Australia is a very, very active, totally different mindset than the rest of us. They tend to, it's not a good day unless you've achieved your bag, so they put a lot of pressure on their people to make sure they get their bag limits and size regulations right, because they'll take everything that they can. But that to then suddenly be not able to get out and have a fish, because just that whole, I can't even imagine what that must have felt like to see all of the carnage and, you know, the fish kills, not just fish kills, but dolphin kills and shark kills and turtle kills and everything that happened with regards to that horrible algal bloom. Thinking about, oh my goodness, I think we've just lost fishing forever, would really mess with my head. So from a compassionate perspective, it's really important that we get out there and make sure that people who may be a little bit blinded by fishing depression know that, oh, okay, I can just pivot for a little while, let this heal and it will heal, and go and do some other sort of fishing. And that's why Steve and I were very quick to stick up our hand and say, absolutely, we'll come over.
Good on you for doing that. Yes, we feel for our South Australian fishing brethren, men and women who love what we love. And finally, are there glimmers of hope? I mean, obviously, seeing the fish you caught in the Coorong, definitely so. But is it coming back? Are there signs of it coming back?
There are. And it seems to be healing much more quickly than they thought it might. I guess it was such a out of left field and unexpected, unprecedented bloom that no one sort of knew what the impact long term was going to be or how quickly it could recover. But it's already showing really good signs of recovering. And the same with the snapper ban that they had. The reports come back that whilst the ban is still in place to allow the snapper population to come back, charter operators are having to move regularly because they can't get away from the snapper, and some of them are really good size, so not all the big ones were lost. So this is really, really good information and good reassurance for all of us that if we are sensible, our resource can recover. We've just got to recognise that it's really easy to push too far, and that we sometimes the politicians or the decision makers need to recognise that it's important to make a decision based on science, not just votes. You know, that short-term mentality of if I get over this particular election or this particular review, then I've got another 4 years and I can kick the can down the road. Sometimes if it's 4 years and you make a good decision that perhaps was unpopular at the time of the marketing and the propaganda, but then within a really short time the results are there, then you might just get more votes next time.
Joe, on that positive note, we'll leave it there. I think, as you've always said, and many of our regulars on The Big Fish, sustainability must be the bottom line, and then we've got a resource to enjoy. Thanks for once again joining us on The Big Fish.
It's always a pleasure. You know that. I'll speak to you soon.
Yeah, good stuff. Joe Starling and Steve Starling just back from a big fishing trip to South Australia to help the locals recover from that devastating algal bloom.
Here comes Stinker with his fishing tips. Some hot advice for your fishing trip. Where to find them? What's the bait?
Are you catching any, mate?
Good morning, Stinker.
Hey, g'day, Scott.
You're looking out the window, and it's looking pretty good, but you won't go until next week. Why is that?
Oh, it's Easter, the school holidays. There are so many people around, and it's a great thing to see. But it also means that I really choose not to launch my boat on the beach because unless I go really early in the morning and come home early, which I don't do these days, but there's so many beach umbrellas and kids have digging holes and having fun. I just think this is their time. I'm happy to hand over a few weeks to our visitors, and as soon as they all leave and the kids go back to school, I'll be down there and doing what I always do. But just give them a tourist time. It is. It's tourist time.
Did you ever drive down a hole when the kids have been laying with their bucket and spade?
not when the kids were actually there. But when I used to fish for mulloway, it was a problem because I'd come home in the dark. When I fished for snapper, I'd come home before dark. But for mulloway, it was the dark. And I'd drive along in the dark and then go boom. Then I'd go this great hole that the kids had dug the day during the daytime. So now I don't have to worry about that because I don't fish for mulloway anymore.
It's aptly named, isn't it, Stinker, that spot?
Oh, Kitty's Corner, yeah. Well, it's so safe and it's so protected. And I just had a look down there yesterday on the top of the tide. The water's crystal clear and the families are down there and the kids are so safe and they can have a swim. Oh, I'm very fortunate that I've chosen Fingal Bay to live in because it offers me with Stinkpot. I mean, Stinkpot is the best launching site on the East Coast, I'm sure. So I can go there 9 times out of 10. I see rather a sea rising over the weekend and into early next week. But if there's any chance of launching, well, Kitty's Corner is the best place to do it.
We're speaking with John Stinker Clark at Port Stephens, and it really is a bit of an epicentre for fishing innovation, isn't it? I remember one of your history books, I think it was Athol Dombrain, a bit of a pioneer, was one of the first Australians, Zane Grey and others had done it overseas, to mount a, because there weren't purpose-built game fishing boats, were there? He mounted a game chair on an old trawler, didn't he?
He did. I'm not sure of the year, but I know the boat. The boat was called the Viking. I think we're in the 40s or maybe 50s. Athol Dombrain, who actually come from Lorne, that's near Maitland, he and others became rather interested in game fishing. So they organised, but like you said, there were no game fishing boats. So what Athol did was to convince a bloke called Jack Jensen, who was a Danish seaman and a fisherman in Nelson Bay at the time, to screw two check chairs onto the deck of his boat. Now, Jack Jensen was very, very protective of the deck of his boat, and he would actually sweep off the sand. So it took some convincing to actually screw these chairs onto the deck. Well, he ended up doing it, and then he used those chairs. They weren't strapped in or anything. They were just sort of swiveling chairs, and you'd sit in it and then hook these almighty creatures and with a centre pin reel. And, of course, then a battle went on for quite some time. Marlin and sharks were the main target. But there was a case, and I was talking to him not long ago, an old bloke, he's 90, and he lives in Mackay. And he came from here a very famous fishing family here was the Mitchell family, and they had two trawlers, and Colin Mitchell was the younger part of the family, and they'd sleep. Part of the family would drive the trawler to wherever they were going, and the other part would have a sleep, and then they might change over at some stage or another. Well, Colin was down below decks having a sleep when Athol Dombrane actually hooked. See, what they did, they would burly to the side of the boat, or they would wait until the trawlers were lifting their bag of fish, and then the boat would be surrounded by sharks. Well, then the game fisherman would pick out the biggest one and throw out a baited hook with a bullock's heart or some leg of lamb or something or other on it, and then the big shark would swallow that and, of course, head off out to sea. Well, this is very interesting to me, that all trawlers carried big guns, and they would use the guns to shoot the sharks to try and protect what they were catching. Well, Colin was down asleep downstairs, and Athol's fighting this monster shark upstairs. So unbeknown to him, he comes onto his watch. He walks up and he sees this massive shark. So he picked up the 303 and went bang. And there's poor old Athol, who'd been fighting this fish for 3 hours. And then all he's got is a shark that Colin shot on the end of the line. These stories just come my way. Everyone knows that I'm interested in all these craziness that happened in the early days of Port Stephens. And so they send them to me, and they send me photos, beautiful old black and white photos. And I reckon I've got probably 1,500 old black and white photos. And a lot of them relate to the fishing industry, not only game fishing, but you see, in trawlers here, the trawler industry is really only recent in comparison. And, of course, the first fishers were the Aboriginal people, and they were very successful in their methods. And, of course, imagine how many fish would have been around in those days too. But getting back onto the trawlers, in 1983, in Port Stephens, there were 23 working trawlers. Today, there's one, and it won't last for the next 5 years. So within 5 years, Port Stephens, which was a huge presenter of fish to the fish markets from trawlers, it will not exist.
How many history books have you written now?
I've written 6. The first one I actually wrote was the Broughton Islanders, and that's just about sold out. I've had reprinted it 3 times, but I think this will be the last time. And then I wrote, after Broughton Islanders, I wrote a book called Old Salt, which was the history of commercial fishing in Port Stephens. And then the oystermen come and knocked on my door, and they said, if you're going to write about those blokes, would you write about us? And they're totally different. And that book, The Oysterman, which took 4 years to write, and I interviewed 60 or 70 families, because that's how I do it. I don't get anything off the internet. I go and speak to the families. And then after that, I did The Lighthouse Keepers on a book called Out of Light. And more recently, and probably my last effort, was a book called Marsh Row, which is more of a farming theme. But it was also on Tillagherry Creek or Marsh Road. It's also about oysters, and oysters and lobsters and fish and timber. Now tourism is what this place is built on.
Good stuff, Stinker. I bet you're chomping at the bit to get out and hit the water again next week when the tourists go home, so you don't run anyone over beach launching. Tight lines, mate.
Yeah. Hooray, Scott.
This is The Big Fish with Scott Levi on ABC Radio.
Our next guest on The Big Fish is Mark Bell, a proud Biripi man who loves his wonderful country and fishing and uses this passion to connect the next generation to culture, community and country. Belly, welcome to The Big Fish.
Yeah, thanks very much for having me on today.
Gee, the power of fishing and the beauty of nature, its healing powers, its connection powers. You've tapped right into that, I believe, on the beautiful Mid-North Coast.
Yeah, and it's a wonderful area here, and it really lends itself to it. So we're really doing a lot, especially with the youth. We find that's very important to get the youth involved and get them out in the salt water and fishing, and also traditional fishing methods. There's benefits from the whole community here, with the elders coming down as well, connecting with the young people, and also just getting out and part of community, doing stuff together, fishing and connecting.
What about sharing knowledge, Belly? Is it something that is fun to do? There are stories, and obviously there's a fair bit of experience in your community.
Oh, we've got some wonderful elders in community here, and everyone's really positive about sharing. And that has to be passed down to the younger generation. Obviously, just to keep things going, a lot of knowledge is not in books and it's not on stuff like that. It comes through elders.
Is there a fair bit of brilliant stuff to mine there when it comes to catching a feed, which really, when you boil it all down, is what it's all about?
Oh, look, 100%. We like to do a lot of camps, so getting the kids out, camping on the riverbanks, things like that, and eating what we're catching at the time. That sustainability is important. Tell them, you know, we don't want to be catching too much. But really getting them out on country and getting a good feed out of it, and really getting back to the roots. Yep.
And what are some of the spots in your country that you love? Where are the places where you just think, wow, this is just heaven?
Oh, look, we've got a beautiful coastline here with the Cairnhaven River, the Hastings River, and we're not too far from the mountains either. So we've got good access to all the freshwater stuff as well. So we could be up in the mountains one day in one of the creeks and then down in the salt water the next day. So the access here is really good to have the best of both worlds.
And where do the kids come from? What's the range?
Pretty much local in community here, although we've had some mob come over from Tamworth and Kempsey, the Nungari mob come down, and we did a couple of combined things together. Basically, especially those inland mobs coming to the salt water, which none of them have ever seen before, and really embracing that, you know, just that sharing of knowledge and culture from people off country.
Must be so much fun. I bet you get a real kick out of that, those kids who've never really fished the salt, and, you know, catching a fish. I mean, it must just put plenty of smiles on dials, mate.
Oh, 100%. We get a lot of kids. That's their first time ever catching a fish or a crab or anything like that. So to see how stoked they are and excited they are, that's the reward that myself and the other members of community get. You really get a big kick out of seeing those kids really light up.
Can you connect that experience to talking around the fire and when to fish, how to fish, where to fish?
That's right. That knowledge that's shared, and like I mentioned before, we have some wonderful elders in community. And that's sitting around the fire, that's where that knowledge is passed on, as well as that hands-on while we're out fishing and just sharing with the young mob all of that knowledge. Like, we do this because, you know, there's a story behind this. This is why we do it. And then there's a lot of traditional stories too around the fishing and the animals and the preservation of country. Yep. And look, we work with a lot of members in community too, that what our big thing at the moment is Indigenous and non-Indigenous coming together to be able to share certain parts of the knowledge too. So everybody's on board and understands and is accepting of knowledge. And it's, you know, it's for thousands and thousands of years that knowledge has been important. And I think it's really good to see things now coming back to more importance based around that knowledge, and Aboriginal people being more listened to in the broader community on how to care for country.
It's The Big Fish, and we're speaking with keen fisho and birripi man Mark Bell on the Mid-North Coast, and he said, call me Belly. No one calls me Mark. And Belly, favourite fish, favourite places? Are you a brim specialist? Do you like to go offshore? Do you love to go up into the fresh water and chase the beautiful bass of your local rivers? I mean, it's the best. The Macleay is just a mecca, isn't it, for big bass? They are just the greatest sports fish ever.
Yeah, look, I like a bit of everything inside and outside. I probably, getting a bit older now, I prefer inside, not as bumpy on the bones. But my favourite fish is actually a mullet. And so a lot of people sort of hear that and go, well, that's crab bait or that's bait. But that's something that we were always brought up on, mullet. And it just, beautiful, fresh mullet, beautiful fish.
Well, the run is just about to start, so it's that time of year where you'll get the beautiful fresh sea run mullet. Not that fast on them up the river, to tell you the truth, Billy, but when they've gone to sea, is there a better fish in the pan?
Oh, look, closer to those, obviously I know what you're saying about them too far up the river. We've got pretty close inlets around here, so there's not a lot of difference between our sea mullet. A lot of them are coming up river. And yeah, we've started to, a few weeks ago, already started doing a bit of spearing, and we're getting a few mullet at the moment, so it's good.
Ah, right. So were these ones that are starting to run, or you're looking at ones that are residents there?
Yeah, we've got a few residents, but they're definitely starting to thicken up now with the run. We do have our cultural fishing rights back here now, so we are allowed to spear in a lot of the areas that we weren't before. Traditional netting and things like that has come back into play as well. So we're sort of self-managing that as a community. We've been working with fisheries and DPI and all the bodies we need to work with there, and they've been fantastic helping us getting our cultural fishing rights back. So that's really opened up a lot of more opportunity within community.
It was interesting, John Stinker Clark on the program just last week was telling our Big Fish audience that he believes that the purse seining and the capture of the mullet on this run at this time every year is a very sustainable thing, in his opinion, that it's been happening for so long. And the Aboriginal people, of course, have great knowledge and were involved heavily in the day and still are, that he believes it's one example of a good sustainable harvest.
Yeah, look, everything's got to be monitored too. Obviously, we're feeding Australia for our professional fishermen, and a lot of those do a wonderful job in monitoring and sustainability as well. And of course, they work with fisheries and DPI. But it is something that we have to think about. We don't want to be depleting our resources within Australia, so it's something that needs to be constantly monitored and not get too carried away. We go, you know, there's a ton of that there. It's never going to run out. And, of course, that could be a big mistake in the end.
Yeah, I guess some are also critical of the use of drones and things that might up the catch to an unsustainable level. And we had a piece on the Big Fish the other day about the Worimi people being very concerned about the over-harvest of pippy. They thought that was something that was a bit unsustainable in their neck of the woods. But it's good to have those custodians there, isn't it, Billy?
That's it. Every community's got their issues, and it's good to now have more of a voice through the governing bodies and having that more of a say. I think it's very, very important to be listening to that knowledge from the elders and about sustainability.
I don't think spearing them would be a problem, particularly with the way I throw something, but that'd be very selective and certainly not a mass harvest. You'd have to be pretty good, wouldn't you?
Yeah, look, that's why we've got all the young mob involved, and that they start off, you know, just missing a few, and then that's where it needs to be, as the young people involved, getting them involved nice and early, building those skills to be able to then eventually pass that knowledge on one day. So, and of course, you know, like thousands of years ago, that knowledge would have started nice and early as young people start to be able to get involved, and that's what we're trying to do now, not leave it till it's too late and that knowledge is lost, or we're trying to teach these young fellas the stuff further down the line. We want to get in nice and early, yep.
That'd be pretty exciting, wouldn't it? A young person getting their first mullet traditionally on a spear, and then maybe roasting over the fire. Is that something that would happen?
Yeah, that's what we do. They spear their own catch. It can be mullet, mud crab, any fish, and everything's just straight on the fire.
What's that like? I mean, the sense of achievement that they've been able to do something that's not easy, Belly.
No, but that sense of achievement from them is amazing, because it's something that they haven't had to go to the shop and buy it. They haven't had to have mum or dad cook it. They haven't had to throw it in the microwave. So really that's given them that self-reliance as well.
Is it also a good way to connect and get the community connected? These young people see that there are elders and people like yourself who are there to talk to if they have any issues, and you can also set the example. Is it a bit of a game changer generationally?
Oh, it definitely is. If we've got young people that are possibly heading, you know, maybe a little bit steering off the path, it's good to bring them back and teach them respect, and not just for their Aboriginal elders and Aboriginal communities, it's respect for everybody. So we do work on that a lot. Just respect, you'll probably hear a lot of times, especially when we're doing the camps and stuff, is probably one of our main things.
Sounds like the best camp ever, Belly. I wish I could be involved in that, and just great. I just think it'd be such fun to do that, and the joy that the kids would get, and the memories, and the connection to country and community, and you know, making those networks, and being healthy and eating healthy. I mean, just ticks every box, doesn't it?
Yeah, that's it. And we're looking at getting them into pathways that suit them as well, you know, career pathways. If they've got that connection to the salt water and country and everything like that, it's good. It's good if they can pursue that, get a role in community, possible jobs off country as well, where they're able to be involved with the fishing industry or things of tourism, things along those lines.
Yeah, and it also connects to the history, doesn't it? That the coastal people were this is what they did. This is how they lived. This was their fridge, I guess.
That's it. Yeah. Look, even when we're down doing the rock pools and stuff on the headlands, we're like, well, we're here at the supermarket. That's basically how it was.
Now, can you settle an argument for me? Starlo told me once that Kundjavoy was a food source, an Indigenous food source. I've used it to catch drummer. I'm sure you have too, and brim and everything else. It's good bait. Of course, only taken sustainably, there's a limit. But is that true?
Look, there is a 50-50 argument on it. It tastes terrible. So, you know, I believe it possibly is a last minute food source. You know, you haven't had a really good couple of days or storms or whatever, things like that. But it doesn't taste nice when you've got other stuff in the same vicinity that tastes a lot better, basically, is the way I'm going to word that one. Yeah.
Good. I'm going to tell Starlo that.
Yep.
I'm glad you agree, because I reckon it'd be a food of last resort as well. It ain't great.
Yeah. Yep.
Although the drummer love it, don't they?
They do.
Yeah.
They do.
Hey, we're about into
it. It was actually used a lot in the fish traps and things like that, because you could just bust it up, throw it in, and it's going to draw the fish in.
Oh, what a good idea. Yeah, the brim and the drummer and the blackfish, they'd all crowd in to eat the kunji, and then you've got them in the traditional fish trap.
That's right.
Reading Anna Clark's book and looking at some of the historical photos of gear that was used, and some of the Irish weaver women who came out with the fleets said, these nets are just, they must be made by some sort of machine. They are too beautifully made. I mean, the gear was very sophisticated. We talk about composite lines and big nets and traps and things. There was some pretty effective stuff being wielded and probably, hopefully, still today by Indigenous fishers.
Yeah, that's it. And we've got some beautiful women in community here weaving and really bringing that back as well. So it's very important, very important.
Look, you've got some work to do. You're in the middle of a cultural burn at the moment. I'll let you go, Belly. Thanks for telling us a little bit about what you do on the mid-north coast of New South Wales. I think our big fish listeners are very envious.
Yeah, look, beautiful country. We've all got to look after it. And hopefully everyone's having good luck out there in the water.
On ABC Radio, it's The Big Fish with Scott Levi.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. You can discover more ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.